Cosmic Shed. Hello and welcome to the Cosmic Shed. I'm Andrew and today's episode is all about Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. Now it's only me in the shed today and as you can probably hear, I'm suffering a little bit with hay fever. So I'll try and keep my contribution to an absolute minimum. But we are going to hear from a lot of guests. And one of those guests that we're going to hear from is Daniel Field, an invertebrate paleontologist from the Milner Centre for Evolution at the University of Bath, who specialises in studying the fossil record to better understand the evolution that has led to the diversity of modern birds that we see today. I'm pretty sure we all know that the birds that we see in our gardens and skies today are the descendants of the dinosaurs. And Daniel Field and his team have made some significant breakthroughs, which you may have read about in the press. We're going to come to that later in the podcast. But like any decent paleontologist, Daniel was inspired by the original Jurassic Park film.
I think he came out in 1993, so I would have been 5 years old. And I remember seeing it for the first time around then. And I mean, I think the first time I saw it, I was absolutely terrified. But I think by the second time I saw it shortly after, I managed to make it through the scary Dilophosaurus scene and really appreciate it for what it was, which was an incredible movie at the time. And I think that movie really went a long way towards inspiring a lot of aspiring young paleontologists, because it focused so much on, I mean, somewhat make-believe, but nonetheless, you know, vaguely cutting-edge science. And, you know, combining that with a really top-notch monster movie. So it really was, I think, an exciting thing for me and many of my peers as well.
We explored the science of Jurassic Park quite deeply in our episode on the original Jurassic World film back in 2015. And we spoke to a whole host of scientists about things like chaos theory and obviously paleontology. But here's a little snippet from that podcast. Beth Shapiro wrote the book on how to clone a mammoth, and I asked her if we actually could really clone a dinosaur.
It's not possible to clone dinosaurs, and that's because cloning requires a living cell, and there's never going to be a living cell for a dinosaur. There's also never going to be a living cell for anything that has been extinct for a long time. So if one really is going to resurrect a species that has been extinct, it has to A, not have been extinct for very long, B, have surviving bits of DNA, C, have a closely related genome that you might be able to use to piece together the surviving bits of DNA into an actual genome sequence, and maybe C, have the capacity to go through and use genome editing technologies to swap out bits of the thing that it's related to that's still alive with bits of the thing that you're trying to bring back. You're never going to be able to create something that's 100% identical to a species that is extinct or has been extinct for a long time. Because even if you could swap out every bit of the DNA in, for example, an Asian elephant genome for a mammoth genome sequence, you would still then have to use an elephant to make this thing come alive. And by virtue of developing within an elephant, being raised by elephants, etc., you would see that the gene expression, even of those mammoth-like genes, might change so that it ended up looking like an elephant.
There's lots more from Beth in that Jurassic World episode, back in the Cosmic Shed archive, which you can find wherever you got this from, or indeed from thecosmicshed.com. Plenty more science coming up, but before that, here's Ty.
So hello, listeners of the Cosmic Shed, this is Ty. Andrew has asked me to talk a little bit about Jurassic World, The Fallen Kingdom.
These creatures were here before us. And if we're not careful, they're going to be here after.
The fifth in the Jurassic Park franchise. It's a follow-up to Jurassic World, which shattered box office records everywhere and I think is currently the fourth biggest film of all time now. Could be the fifth. I think it's Avatar, Titanic, maybe the latest Avengers. Then Jurassic... Oh, no. Force Awakens is in there somewhere. Let's say top five. Anyway, This follows on the exploits of the last Jurassic World film, where the problems of containing dinosaurs in an amusement park once again failed to work out as humans intended, and the dinosaurs escaped, people were eaten, and everyone had a pretty good fun time. This time, Owen Grady and Claire, played by Chris Pratt and Bryce Dallas Howard, are back because what used to be a dormant volcano on Isla Nublar is about to explode, killing all the dinosaurs. Claire has kind of gone from being the corporate overlord of the park to being a dinosaur rights advocate, and she uses Owen's relationship with the last surviving raptor, Blue, which he trained from birth, to convince him to come back and save the dinosaurs. However, the company that are sponsoring their project might want the dinosaurs for more nefarious purposes. So while the last film was directed by Colin Trevorrow, this is actually directed by J.A. Bayona, who directed the brilliant horror film The Orphanage. He also did A Monster Calls and also The Impossible, which was a film about the Asian tsunami. So Bayona has a really good eye for spectacle and can bring the chills, and he definitely does in this film, which I have to say is probably the scariest Jurassic Park film, maybe after the first. It's definitely got some darker elements. I really enjoyed it. There were those that didn't enjoy Jurassic World. There were lots of criticisms that it was basically the first film with a new coat of paint on it and just reheated in the microwave. And, you know, those criticisms are valid. And the problem with the Jurassic Park films is you just can't keep going back to the same island. People don't want to go there, they get eaten. So what Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom does is what Alan Grant said in the first film, which was dinosaurs and humans, you know, two species separated by 65 million years, suddenly thrust together. We can't possibly know what's going to happen. So this is definitely an attempt to broaden out the Jurassic World, and it does so quite well. There are some elements of the film that I think are going to draw criticism, but on the whole, I had a really good time with it, and personally think it's a step up from Jurassic World. It's no Jurassic Park. I'm one of the very few people who even rates Jurassic Park The Lost World, but it's definitely better than Jurassic Park 3. Music is, of course, done by Michael Giacchino. Definitely highly recommend you guys hurry to your nearest cinema to see this. Jeff Goldblum returns as Dr. Ian Malcolm. He's only in it for about 10 minutes, but it's good to see him there. And everything he says is absolutely correct. People should learn. They've just got to listen to Ian Malcolm more often, and the world would be a much safer, less sharp-toothed place.
I'll tell you the problem with the scientific power that you're using here. It didn't require any discipline to attain it. You know, you read what others had done, and you took the next step. You didn't earn the knowledge for yourselves, so you don't take any responsibility for it. You stood on the shoulders of geniuses to accomplish something as fast as you could, and before you even knew what you had, you patented it and packaged it and slapped it on a plastic lunchbox, and now you're selling it. You want to sell it. Well,
I don't think you're giving us our due credit. Our scientists have done things which nobody's ever done before.
Yeah, but your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could that they didn't stop to think if they should.
More from Ty later in the podcast. But Daniel Field is the lead researcher on a couple of papers which have been published recently, which answer a question that my daughter put to me recently and that I've thought myself sometimes. So I asked it to Daniel. And the question was, if the birds are the descendants of the dinosaurs, why do we say that the dinosaurs were wiped out by the asteroid that hit the Earth?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. We know that dinosaurs persisted all the way up until the end Cretaceous mass extinction event 66 million years ago, which was a horrible time on Earth, not just for dinosaurs, but pretty much anything else, sort of regardless of the ecosystem that you inhabited. And so we know that the early ancestors of what we think of as modern birds would have existed in the late part of the Cretaceous, before the asteroid struck. And so, you know, there's a fascinating question there, which is how did the sort of deepest lineages within modern bird diversity manage to persist across this horrific mass extinction event and survive to diversify in its aftermath, en route to becoming arguably the most diverse group of living tetrapods with almost 11,000 living species. So this is a major question, and it's one that has been challenging to answer, you know, previously, partly because in all likelihood, the relevant time frame for understanding the extinction event was relatively brief. I mean, this asteroid struck, it would have set off a very short-term and severe cascade of horrible ecological phenomena, which are themselves difficult to reconstruct from our position in the present 66 million years later, simply because they would have taken place over such short timescales. So we really have become fascinated by this question of how and why modern birds managed to survive this mass extinction event, and I think piece by piece we're sort of moving towards answering it in better detail.
Okay, but you've had a bit of a breakthrough.
Yeah, so we published a couple of papers recently sort of focused on that question specifically, and we think that there were probably a couple of factors that would have been instrumental in helping various lineages of birds make it through this mass extinction event, one of which would have been being relatively small-bodied, which probably would have been a favorable attribute for any surviving organism, simply because the absolute metabolic requirements of a small-bodied organism are smaller than a large-bodied organism. But recently we sort of looked at this question from more of an ecological standpoint, and we think that there is strong evidence that any birds that were specialized for life in the trees prior to the mass extinction event likely would have succumbed to the extinction. And, you know, by contrast, birds that would have been at least facultatively or optionally non-arboreal or non-tree-dwelling would have been favored. And that conclusion is based on evidence from the pollen fossil record, which suggests that global forests around the world were devastated in the immediate aftermath of the asteroid impact.
Well, maybe dinosaurs have more in common with present-day birds than they do with reptiles.
Look at the pubic bone, turned backward, just like a bird. Look at the vertebrae, full of air sacs and hollows, just like a bird.
And even the word raptor means bird of prey.
That doesn't look very scary. More like a six-foot turkey.
Turkey, huh?
Oh, no.
Okay. Try to imagine yourself in the Cretaceous period. You get your first look at this six-foot turkey as you enter a clearing. He moves like a bird, lightly bobbing his head. And you keep still because you think that maybe his visual acuity is based on movement like T-Rex. And he'll lose you if you don't move. But no, not Velociraptor. You stare at him, and he just stares right back.
And what would they look like, these birds that were living on the ground at that time?
As far as we can tell, you know, in the latest part of the Cretaceous, there was quite a diversity of bird-like organisms around, both things, organisms that are within what we think of as modern bird biodiversity today, as well as very bird-like dinosaurs, you know, close relatives of modern birds that were nonetheless outside of modern bird biodiversity. And as far as we can tell, all of these lineages of bird-like animals that were outside modern bird diversity, you know, managed to persist up to the end Cretaceous mass extinction event itself, and they didn't persist any further. They appear to have gone extinct at that point in time. Whereas some of the deepest branches within the modern bird tree of life appear to have crossed over the end Cretaceous mass extinction event. And since we think that these animals were likely relatively small-bodied and likely predominantly ground-dwelling birds, they may well have, at least superficially, looked something like small partridges.
Okay. How did you do that then? How can you piece together
that kind of story from something that happened a long time ago.
Right. Well, so there were sort of two distinct approaches here. One is based on the direct evidence that the fossil record provides, which obviously is sort of the strongest source of many of these sorts of inferences. But we also took more of an analytical, biological approach, factoring in the fact that we now have a clearer picture of what the bird tree of life actually looks like than we ever have before. So I guess I'll answer the question in two parts. I can talk about the fossil evidence itself, but many of the conclusions that we drew were based on these inferences based on the bird tree of life, so I'd like to get into that as well. But on the sort of the direct fossil evidence side of things, you know, it's no secret that the bird fossil record is relatively sparse compared to the fossil record of, you know, many other groups of vertebrate animals. Since birds are relatively small in general and relatively lightweight, they don't necessarily fossilize that well. But nonetheless, there was a group of extremely successful, very diverse and globally widespread bird-like animals called, well, the technical term is enantiornithines, which means opposite birds. And so these were, you know, for all intents and purposes, very bird-like dinosaurs that survived all the way up to the end Cretaceous mass extinction event 66 million years ago, and then didn't survive any further. So there are over 80 kinds of opposite birds that have been described so far, and the majority of opposite birds that have been discovered with their feet intact exhibit a foot morphology which is very similar to what we see in living perching birds. So they exhibit elongated and reversed hind toes with recurved claws, which are generally taken to be features representative of perching birds. So for a long time, at least the vast majority of these opposite birds have interpreted have been interpreted as having been tree dwelling, and therefore the fact that the disappearance of these opposite birds coincides with fossil plant evidence for the devastation of forests across the end Cretaceous mass extinction may well explain why this previously very successful group of bird-like animals didn't make it. On the other side of things, if we look at the early Cenozoic fossil record of modern birds, so the Cenozoic is the period of time following the end Cretaceous mass extinction event, we see early fossil representatives of some modern groups that today live in trees that do not exhibit sort of the specialized perching hind limb features that we would expect to see for tree-dwelling birds. So they don't show the same sort of foot specializations that we see in their modern descendants, suggesting that perhaps the transition towards tree-dwelling in some of these early Cenozoic lineages actually took place later than we otherwise would have guessed, probably after global forests would have rebounded from their devastation following the asteroid impact. So the direct bird fossil evidence sort of relies on sort of those pieces of data. But the strongest part of the argument, I think, comes from inferences we can draw from studying the modern bird tree of life. So within the last few years, we've succeeded in coming up with a much clearer picture, first of all, of how the major groups of living birds are related to one another, but also a clearer picture of when in Earth history these major lineages of birds diverged from one another. And we think that a very rapid diversification event occurred within modern birds shortly after the end Cretaceous mass extinction event. So we see many of these deep lineages within the modern bird tree of life sort of coalescing in the period of time immediately following the mass extinction event. And we can use some techniques today from looking at the ecological habits of modern birds and combine those data with our picture of this time-scaled bird tree of life to statistically estimate the probability that sort of the ancestor of all modern birds would have, say, either lived in the trees or lived on the ground or exhibited sort of more of a mixed ecology. So we used that statistical approach to estimate what the ecologies of the most recent common ancestor of all living birds likely would have been like, as well as many of the other ancestral states deep within the modern bird tree of life. And when we do that, we find strong statistical support for the idea that only non-tree-dwelling birds survived across the end Cretaceous mass extinction event, and that the numerous independent transitions towards life in the trees that subsequently took place across the bird tree of life happened after the mass extinction event, again, likely after global forests had rebounded from the asteroid impact.
Well, if I think about life on other planets, which I do quite often, and I think about the likelihood of it happening, it feels a bit like it sort of happened twice on Earth, right? It's sort of, because there was this mass extinction, or is everything after the mass extinction was there before the extinction, and it's only the things that survived, and then there was this rapid diversification. Is that
yeah, I mean, I think, you know, life on Earth really sort of hit at least a partial reset button, you know, following the mass extinction event, and I think it profoundly altered the course of, you know, the evolutionary history of so many of those groups that actually passed through the mass extinction event. There are a handful of sort of modern groups of vertebrate animals that don't seem to have noticed the mass extinction event quite as much as others. For example, many groups of vertebrates that live in freshwater environments, like turtles and crocodilians, you suffered some degree of extinction following the asteroid impact, but seemed to have largely been buffered from the severity and selectivity of the extinction that we see in other groups, like, you know, for example, birds many groups of organisms that failed to persist across the mass extinction event. And so trying to figure out which factors may have favored the survival of you know, the lucky groups that crossed the end Cretaceous mass extinction, and comparing those insights with what we can reconstruct for those organisms that failed to persist, I think has potential to give us insight into what happens, you know, in the face of global catastrophes more generally.
I'm going to resist saying that I feel like we need a bit of a reset now.
Well, it might be coming whether you want it or not. Let's not get into that.
Right, okay, let's do some science fiction. So you love Jurassic Park.
Sure.
Let's go through Jurassic Park 2.
Oh, God, I've got to be totally honest with you. My feelings about Jurassic Park, the original film, and the other, you know, subsequent however many there have been, you know, they're not the same. You know, most of the subsequent movies kind of blend together for me. I think I've seen them all, and I saw the one last night, but my recollection of the new one that I saw last night is a little bit hazy too. They're not as good as the original, to put it bluntly.
Okay, but okay, let's talk about Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom then.
I thought it actually, you know, to be totally honest, I thought it was pretty fun, and I think it was more fun to watch and sort of a little bit less cringe inducing than some of the previous sequels. That's not to say that it wasn't cringe inducing, but yeah, I mean, I did enjoy it, and I think my very favorite part of the movie happened sort of early on. I don't know, are spoiler alerts allowed here?
Yeah,
sure. I mean, you know, the whole world has undoubtedly seen it by now, right? So, you know, all of the dinosaurs on the island are sort of stampeding away from the volcanic explosion. I kind of loved that because, you know, I'm a bird watcher. I spend a lot of time in the field, you know, observing and photographing birds and other living animals. And that was just kind of fun because, you know, you could kind of keep your eye on a pretty cool diversity of awesome dinosaurs running down the slope and sort of pick out your favorites. And yeah, I don't know. I thought that was kind of fun.
Well, so at that moment, I found myself going, this is just so cool. I'm loving this film. It's so much fun. And then actually I carried on enjoying it enough.
There were some pretty scary parts. I thought that, you know, probably the goriest thing I've seen in any Jurassic Park movie took place in this one, you know, where the guy's arm gets removed, shall we say. I thought that was, you know, pretty gross.
Yeah, completely. So when you're watching it and other films, does your kind of knowledge of science spoil it in any way, enhance it? What, how do you feel about it?
Well, I mean, you know, you're always kind of calculating things in your mind, I guess. It, you know, if you go to a Jurassic Park movie, you're prepared to, as a paleontologist at least, to suspend your disbelief a little bit, you know, in order to enjoy yourself. And I think that's what was so cool about the first movie, right? I mean, a lot of it was speculative, a lot of it was totally fanciful, and a lot of it was wrong. But everything that they sort of talked about in that movie was at least vaguely rooted in somewhat plausible science, right? Like, if you just sort of imagine that genomic material can persist for over 66 million years without degrading, which unfortunately it apparently cannot, you know, there's a really cool narrative that can spring from that, and obviously that's sort of what Michael Crichton seized on, and I think it's a really, really cool premise for a story. That seems to not have been a priority, I think, for the writers and directors of many of the subsequent films, at least, you know, sort of rigorously rooting the story in kind of vaguely plausible science. But I thought that this film was a little less guilty of some of the sort of egregious stretches than others have been.
So you didn't like Jurassic World, the first one, then?
Yeah, I don't remember it super clearly. I thought the enormous mosasaur jumping out of the, you know, the killer whale SeaWorld tank was pretty cool. that's maybe my most endearing memory of it, other than, you know, being surprised that Andy Dwyer from Parks and Rec got so ripped.
What I really loved in this one was the way they'd kind of taken the criticism of that first one and just kind of sometimes overtly and sometimes subtly responded to it, like when Bryce Dallas Howard's character puts her foot down on the pedal and there's a shot to show that she's not wearing high heels.
No, actually, that's something that I did notice. That's interesting, yeah.
Is there something you'd like to see in the next film? I kind of want to see Jurassic Park Swindon, or, you know, Jurassic World Swindon, or Jurassic World Ipswich, or, you know, just something a bit different.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Bath. I mean, that would be an interesting juxtaposition here, you know, lovely Georgian architecture, scary Mesozoic monsters. I mean, why not?
If you were going to see dinosaurs brought back, which I assume you don't want to see, but if you were going to do that, which would you bring back first?
Oh, boy. You know, I mean, so I'm obviously biased. I spend pretty much all my time thinking about either, you know, the early kind of post-extinction recovery of modern birds, or the sort of very bird-like dinosaurs that existed sort of in the latter part of the age of reptiles, you know, that sort of sequentially acquired what we think of today as bird-like features. And so I and many of my close colleagues spent a lot of time imagining what the biology of many of these, you know, very bird-like dinosaurs actually would have been like. Would something like Archaeopteryx have been capable of what we think of today as modern, sophisticated flight? That is a contentious question, and sort of a lot of us have sort of strongly held opinions on the subject based on sort of various pieces of data that we either upweight or downweight, depending on our own, I guess, cognitive biases. But I'd kind of like to see Archaeopteryx in the flesh and sort of find out once and for all how bird-like this animal actually would have been.
Yeah, that would be awesome. I want to see a Parasaurolophus. That's just incredible.
That's a good one, and that's a great choice, because that's a good Albertan dinosaur. And as an Albertan paleontologist, you know, that's one that's always kind of been near and dear to my heart. I mean, to be honest, these you know, awesome kind of giant dinosaurs more distantly related to birds like that are still, you know, so fun to think about, so fun to see sort of reincarnated on screen. And I wouldn't say no to seeing one of those. Probably one of the ones you'd have to worry about the least as well.
Feeling the uniform direction changes, just like a flock of birds evading a predator.
They're flocking this way.
Didn't they look like herd?
Well, that's certainly how they were depicted in the first Jurassic Park movie. A lot of hadrosaurs are known from sort of mass death assemblages, and the interpretation there is that, you know, these animals were social and lived in large groups and periodically died en masse together, maybe in massive flooding events. I think that seems very plausible, at least around the parts where I'm from in Alberta. Parasaurolophus specifically is a very uncommon dinosaur. There's an extraordinary, I think the original Parasaurolophus specimen was discovered in Dinosaur Provincial Park in southern Alberta. But I think there's only one good specimen, and I could be wrong about that, but I think there's only one good specimen known from around there. That said, I think there are Parasaurolophus bone beds known from the western U.S., but I'm kind of veering a little further away from bird evolution here into just being sort of a dino fan.
What's that head about? What's the purpose of that head?
Yeah, I don't know. I think the idea that it was some kind of resonant chamber that might have, altered the vocalizations that they made is a cool idea. I think that idea has been tested using CT scanning in order to peer inside the skulls of these animals, and I think that idea, based on that work, is still plausible. I think that work was led by a friend and colleague of mine, a dinosaur paleontologist at the Royal Ontario Museum named David Evans, and I should be more familiar with the conclusions than I am. But I think that's a plausible idea. You kind of look around the modern world today, and there are all sorts of really cool sort of cranial ornamentations that we see in living animals. And, trying to understand what that crazy crest was about, and trying to understand what the frills of horned dinosaurs were all about, is not always easy to do. And it's possible that there are sort of non-mutually exclusive alternative ideas that are potentially accurate there. There are a lot of cool looking mammal skulls out there today. For example, if you go to East Africa on safari, you'll see, you know, tons of cool cranial elaborations, across the antelopes that are alive today. And understanding exactly what all of that is about in the modern world today is not always easy to answer definitively either. Probably it just comes down to looking good and that being selected over time and driving that sort of phenotypic divergence among close relatives. But I'm not sure how well we truly understand that even in the modern world. Sexiness driving evolution of external phenotypes among organisms, I think that really matters. And I think that a lot of these kind of big questions that we might try to answer from more of an adaptive standpoint, you know, what good would that, you know, crest have done? I don't know how it would have helped it in a fight with a large theropod trying to take it down. It may well be that it was, found to be attractive. Humans find all kinds of weird things attractive. So, why should it be different for hadrosaurs?
Thanks, Daniel. Now, before I went into the film, I had, I have to say, pretty low expectations. I had a lot of fun watching Jurassic World back in 2015, but it was certainly flawed. And essentially, I was thinking, okay, I'm going to be all right. As long as I hear that amazing theme tune and see some dinosaurs, I'm going to be okay, right? Obviously, the John Williams score wasn't there, but Michael Giacchino did a superb job on the music. And recently, Ty went to a concert by the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra
here at Bristol's Colston Hall. And he met up with a conductor and a composer of computer game music before they took the stage to talk about not only composing music, but choosing pieces to play in a concert called Heroes versus Monsters.
So I'm here at the Bristol Colston Hall with Pete Harrison, conductor for the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra, and Richard Jakes, composer of numerous video games, including James Bond Bloodstone, which is being performed tonight. The concert tonight is Heroes and Monsters, where the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra will be playing a wide selection of classic film themes, which is kind of relevant seeing as Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom is out this week. What is it about monster movies that inspired you to come up with this concert and this lineup in particular, Pete?
I think we've done a whole series of heroes and concerts, heroes and superheroes being the obvious one that gives you all the Marvel DC comics, as well as classical music that's been used in those films as well. So then that was so popular, we did a second one, which led on, I mean, there's different strands of heroes and features in films. So aliens, heroes and monsters for this one. So looking at the monsters we've got, you know, from King Kong through to, you know, the Abyss, the things that appear down there and so on and so on. So yes, it's there's lots of good repertoire that we thought would work for us.
And is it you that comes up with the lineup? How is the lineup put together? Do you kind of all get together and go, let's do The Mummy and The Abyss, that's not often played, or let's do the hits?
It's a little bit depends on what's available as well. So okay. we look and see what music we can hire, but it's quite often done over a glass of wine with a pal of mine in the orchestra who programs all these things with me. We sit down and just have a chat and see what works really, and then I can have a look, and you know, this is where Richard comes in, because I can look and see what music there is going from colleagues and friends that I know that are composing things and see how that works. Obviously Bond being a great hero anyway, and I saw Richard had just been recording the Bloodstone soundtrack, and I thought, well, I'll, you know, quick line and say, is there anything we could use in our concert? And here we are. So it's just finding what's available. We're featuring a piece by David Buckley as well tonight.
Okay.
Another friend. It's from a video game as well. So that's not in your usual concert programming. So something fresh for the audiences here and fresh for the orchestra as well, which always goes down well.
Mm. Well, Jurassic World's theme is obviously iconic. John Williams and Michael Giacchino has taken it and evolved it for the Jurassic World films.
Mm.
Richard, you're obviously composer of the James Bond games. When you've got like a legacy of composers like John Barry and David Arnold, how do you put your own unique spin on something that iconic while
I think
pleasing
it's
the fans and doing something original?
Yeah. It's a good question. I think you know, any composer that is working on an established franchise is always respectful of the music that have gone before, because as you said, it's a big legacy, and has a, you know, Bond has a rich tapestry history with you know, those two composers in particular, John Barry and David Arnold. For me, myself, I mean, every composer has their own little quirks and tips and tricks and stylistic ideas. So it's a question of being, you know, respectful and keeping the music within the sort of tapestry of what's gone before, but also just injecting sort of some new ideas, some maybe things that haven't been done. I write a lot of, you know, I try to write a lot of energy into the Bond score that I worked on, and that's something I was keen to do. So, you know, I try to keep it a modern retro score, if you see what I mean. That's the kind of the idea behind it.
So Pete, over the years you've put more and more computer game themes into the lineup. Why is that? Is it because you're trying to get in like a younger audience, or just computer games themes inherently becoming more cinematic?
Yes.
To both?
Yes, to everything. It's gone are the days, I think, of the little tiny speaker space invader noises and things. Now technology's moved on, we can get full orchestral scores on the discs, so opens up the opportunities for composers to write these wonderful orchestral scores. The technology's moved on in the graphics as well, so that as games and films get ever closer, we get the matching. We're doing the score to Jurassic Park and Jurassic Park 2, The Lost World, tonight, and Giacchino's, one of his first scores he wrote with the full orchestra was The Lost World. So, you know, I think you've got these parallels going. Lego, of course, do a version of everything as well, which brings up new scores as well. But also, yes, brings new audiences in, because there's nothing like the sound of an orchestra playing live. And if you actually, and my first experience was sitting in this very hall, Colston Hall here in Bristol, watching an orchestra called the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra.
Never heard of it.
I'm sure they're very good, but and so that was, I still remember it to this day, you know, that sitting there watching this. And so I was thinking, that's the sound. Then I started playing and conducting and so on. So if we can get younger people people to actually see, A, that we're human beings. We're not robots up there or very dull people. We're actually quite fun, a lot of us as well. And have fun playing the music and play some flipping good music as well. Then I think that's all good. And if also educating the older audiences as well. And I love it when I first was talking about this, and I did a pre-concert talk, and I said, okay, and we're featuring video game music. And you could see the whole, this guy. I said, all right, you just let us play it. Then we'll have a chat afterwards and see what you think. And this is fantastic. It's as good as any classical music, any film scores being written for the video game market these days. And you know, your Bloodstone thing, I think it's fantastic. And Barry, I say tonight, and Barry would have been proud. He would put his name to that. He would, you know, it's very much in that style and genre, you know. And that's a difficult thing to do, wasn't it? I mean, things like The Incredibles, that he wanted, they wanted Barry
they
to
wanted
do
Barry,
that.
Yeah,
but he said, no, you just want on Her Majesty's Secret Service again. I've already done that, so I don't want to do it again. So they got Giacchino to do it, to do, you know, his homage to it. So, and again, it's as specific, as you say, the tapestry of the sound and what works. And you know, you've done a cracking job on it. So which you wait to hear the audience reaction tonight. They're going nuts. Well, they haven't the other concerts we've done so far. So, yeah.
Richard, there's a lot of crossover between computer games and films. So like Giacchino started off doing computer games, that's went right. into TV on Lost and Alias, and now Oscar-winning film composer. And likewise, Hans Zimmer, big film composer, does computer games like Call of Duty, and Henry Jackman's done the Uncharted films. Do you find that that just opens up more opportunity for you, or do you find that when big names are kind of coming into the computer game arena, it crowds out more up-and-coming artists?
I think a bit of... I don't think it's a negative thing. I mean, you know, Michael Giacchino, first time I met him was at a video game conference about, you know, 15, 20 years ago when he was still working with DreamWorks Interactive before he started working in television and film. I think for opportunities for myself, I mean, you know, I was a classic trained musician. I followed a very similar path to a lot of, you know, composers, friends of mine. And it's like Pete was saying about the technology, that's been a really important part. When I did my Headhunter score back in 2001, that was actually the first video game soundtrack ever to be recorded at Abbey Road Studios with a full orchestra. And then other concerts I've been involved in have been like the first one in Hollywood Bowl, the first one in Poland, etc., etc. So it's really good that the audience are embracing it. But also when composers are crossing between one genre and the other, I think it gives a certain amount of recognition that the video game industry really has come of age. There is a huge amount of talent working in it, and I've got, you know, my friend and colleague Jesper Kidd, another game composer, I was talking to him last week, and he's been doing some film as well, and he's done Assassin's Creed and all these huge games. So I think it's just if you're a good composer and your music gets heard and recognised, then you'll be hired to do all sorts of different things. And yeah, I've had opportunities present themselves just by being starting in video game scoring. Very exciting future.
Right, let's talk about monster movies, because obviously that's a big theme. What are your personal favourite monster movies? And they don't have to be the same, but monster movie theme.
Richard, you go first. Don't give me time to think.
Well, I can name a couple. Aliens is a terrific score.
James Horner.
I absolutely love James Horner. You know, it's quite a chromatic aleatoric score, so I wouldn't necessarily be able to hum it to you, but it's just a genius score and so effective. Monster theme, I'll let Pete put one in, then I'll give you another one.
Monster ones, the ones we're doing tonight, I'm a big fan of Psycho, the Bernard Herrmann score.
Bernard Herrmann, yeah.
Which I love the fact it was done on a budget, and he was only given a string orchestra to play with, but what's his name? Hitchcock didn't want music for a lot of it. He wasn't a huge fan of the music anyways. And he did a film called The Lifeboat, and he said, well, where would the orchestra be? And I think that, you know, Herrmann said, well, you tell me where the cameras would be and I'll tell you where the orchestra would be, because it's filmed on a lifeboat in the middle of the sea. But he didn't want music in the shower scene. And it was literally done where Herrmann just recorded it, and on a playthrough of that section, there was the music for it. And I think he said, okay, yes, now I see, because he had a lot of respect for the amount he'd contributed to the film. So, but it's such an eerie score, and I can't imagine that film without it. So Jurassic Park is just such a stirring theme as well, I think.
It
works very well.
So what's also on the lineup is one of the most iconic movie monsters of all time, King Kong, but you're doing the John Barry score to the 70s film where he's on top of the World Trade Center.
James Newton Howard score, the 2005 film.
You are? Okay. Yes, see, yes, it lies to me here on your program. I was wondering why not the Max Steiner and why not Peter Jackson's James Newton Howard?
Yeah.
I thought it was a curious choice going for the...
We looked at all of them. Yeah. I'm a big fan of Steiner's work, a huge fan of John Barry. But we've done a lot of John Barry in concerts in the past, and I wouldn't say it's all the same. It's very similar bits, but I think this score just stood out, and there's a great sweep from it. And we haven't featured much James Newton Howard, so in it goes. And it's, dare I say, it's not the greatest of films, I think, but it's one of these examples of where there's a fantastic soundtrack on a slightly... I wouldn't say dodgy, but you know what I mean.
It's an indulgent film.
It's a very indulgent film,
for Peter Jackson, who's a big King Kong fan. This is clearly his, I'm going to put everything into this.
Yes.
As someone who owns the director's cut, it's definitely one of those films you need like a Sunday afternoon to watch. Something you can just drink it in rather than put it on in the evening.
And that, I mean, the early, the 1933 film, wasn't it? I think the original one, that score from Steiner is a great score as well. Yeah. I think that, and the film is a good film, even though it's so clunky and creaky in those early animations of Kong up the top there with Fay Wray in his hand.
Still a great movie, though.
It is a great movie, definitely.
And is there anything you regret leaving off the playlist tonight or the programme? Is there any monster theme that you were like, I wish I could have got this?
I agree with Richard about Aliens, all those scores, but we've done that in our Heroes and Aliens, we better not repeat that. We did a bit of Frankenstein in one of the earlier concerts. We did a bit of Howard Shaw Silence the Lambs in the earlier concerts as well. But that's an interesting one, because it's the film stands up anyway. I wouldn't say it doesn't need music, but he wrote a fantastic score that just sits there. Mm. Quietly doesn't sit on top of everything. It sits, just adds where necessary in the background, which didn't make it, funny enough, the strongest score to sit on stage on its own.
Yeah.
That's, you know, very few scores don't work, if you see what I mean that way. But sadly, that one didn't work quite as well, so we had to drop it.
Is that a trick to like a memorable monster theme? Something either simplistic, like the Jaws or the Psycho, which is just, you know, beating the strings, or the two tone Jaws theme, or something like a beautiful melody like the Jurassic Park theme.
I think it does help, doesn't it? And it helps have something you whistle on the way out, which you wouldn't have done with Silence of the Lambs. You can sing the tune for that.
Exactly. It's interesting. There's, you know, a lot of people ask me about this, and there has been a trend in Hollywood in recent years to sort of maybe go away from thematic work, which I don't particularly agree with, because I think everything has its place. Mm. And I think more, you know, movies with more what I would describe as musical sound design also has its place, and it's very, very good. But, you know, when the audience connect with a movie, they often connect with it through the music, or the music helps them connect to the story and the characters and the images. So I think, you know, it's been a tried and tested format for, 100 years or something. And when I'm composing, I actually usually write my main themes away from my studio. I normally do it just sort of in my head. And some of the themes for Bloodstone written on the top deck of a bus in London, where I just scribbled them down on the back of a bank statement, actually. So that's how, you know, it's not sitting in my big glamorous studio in London all the time. And I just feel that sort of helps a theme breathe, because, you know, a good theme has to have a good shape, you know, a certain amount of recognisability, and all those kind of things. So, yeah, I think it does help a film, whether it's a hero or a monster film. I think it helps both.
And it helps us as the audience as well, I think, doesn't it? And however subliminal, and John's the master of this, but he took that from Wagner, you know, the different motifs for within something like the Ring, the Nibelung, the 5 days of opera, whatever it is, which goes on forever. But whenever Wotan appears, there's that theme, his spear's got another theme, and so on and so on. It's same with this, even if you're not sure what happened, and Star Wars, of course, being a great example, here come the original characters back again, and there's Princess Leia's theme suddenly appears, and think, doesn't, oh my god, it is, it's her, of course. We knew, because we'd read about it before. You know, bless her soul now. But and that's just, it's a subliminal way of just helping you through the film, I think.
Great. Well, thanks very much for doing this, guys. I hope you guys have a great concert tonight.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you. Audience.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Can I put a plug in? We're back with Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra next year over at the Forum over in Bath, because they're closing the Colston Hall here for much needed renovations.
What's the theme for next year?
It's going to be, hopefully, still two of the greatest living composers, Williams versus Zimmer. So it's a
melody versus percussive.
Exactly. Yes, it's not going to be a competition, but it's a celebration of both of their works, which I think is going to be a good evening.
Yeah.
Yes.
Kings of the blockbusters.
Absolutely.
Nice.
Yes.
Brilliant.
Yes. Yes.
All right. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to everyone who talked to us for this episode and saved everyone from listening to me too much with this hay fever. Maddie and Steve, if you're listening, finish up those PhDs and come back to the shed. We miss you. We'll be back soon, and I'm not sure what's next, but I did have a good chat with the man who got the Nobel Prize for demonstrating that CFCs were causing the hole in the ozone layer. So I guess we'll bring you that soon. And thank you very much for listening.
Life finds a way.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.